one of the presentations so that we can have the questions and answers recorded. So if you want to tune into the session or record it again or look at the recording of it, that we'll have those. I don't think this can be removed. I'm going to step aside and then entertain any questions so that the presenters can come up to the microphone. Questions?
This is a question for the first presenter, I think, Corina.
Corina.
Yeah, that was really nice work and impressive that you got such a big sample of 270 through that method. And I really appreciate how thoroughly you went through the data and the insight that you got. It sounds like a couple of the risk factors that you identified might be part of like domains of health literacy. But health literacy is a really hard thing to define and put your finger on. I don't know. Coming away, do you think much about health literacy? I'm wondering if there's a role to try to better define health literacy and identify health literacy as something that could be improved to be protective against HIV and STDs.
Well, I agree with you because factors we identified are education, right, as a risk factor. And we also identified that higher level of education is protective against, you know, STI. And from the little I know about Ecuador, by speaking with those who are on the ground there, they claim that, you know, the government, they do a lot regarding educating the sex workers, but I think they need to do more. So it's a fact that a lot of these people are not, they don't have a lot of knowledge regarding sex, preventing STI, you know, what's it called, adequate sexual, what's it called, sorry, reducing sexual risk behavior, like wearing their condoms regularly and negotiating safe sex and all that. So it's a big deal. So health literacy is actually a big deal, and it's a factor that leads to increased STI and HIV amongst sex workers. I agree with you, and part of the recommendation is, you know, we need to educate sex workers more, you know, about the sexual risk behaviors and improve their knowledge and empower them so that they can negotiate safe sex. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
What other questions do we have?
I think a couple of questions. The two in the middle, you referred to human trafficking a couple of times. And I was just wondering what role that played in your study in terms of differentiating, if you were able to, between sex workers and those who were trafficked. And then also, for everyone, I suppose, what have you seen as the impact of so much money going into anti-human trafficking and how that impacts the work that you do?
That's a really good question. So we didn't go into the study thinking so much about human trafficking, especially because of the massage parlor environment. People tend to see it as more of a venue where people have a lot of choices. And part of that was our naivete. So we kind of stepped into a very, I'd say, contentious debate around human trafficking. And so in our interviews with providers, I think what's coming up the most is that this debate about whether a person can choose to be a sex worker. And so a lot of the human trafficking funded organizations really believe that you can't, or that it's very rare. And so a lot of the focus is on determining that a woman was trafficked and then getting the appropriate services for her and accessing particular funding streams because she's disclosed trafficking. She becomes eligible for certain types of visas, certain types of grant support, and she also gets introduced into the law enforcement system to start helping to identify the traffickers. And so it really kind of begins to eclipse looking at the whole spectrum of a massage parlor worker's experience or a sex worker's experience. And so I think that's sort of how I see it in terms of how it affects the programmatic expression of the services that these women get. So it's really very complex debate. I don't feel like there's a right or wrong answer. I think the point is to see the reality as it is instead of the kind of reality that gets imposed when there are funding mechanisms behind it.
Other questions?
I have a question to Dr.
Keynes.
So you mentioned that one of the questions that you asked was regarding like fear of police taking away condoms. I obviously understand there's a lot of police corruption in a lot of parts of the world, but can you talk about like the rationale behind asking those specific questions?
Thanks. So as I was saying, the project had the survey was quite long, quite lengthy, and so there was a whole series of questions around condom negotiation and also perpetrators of violence and so on. So yes, there was an idea that there was a kind of thought that basically there's this large pressure from they call them the uniform folks, so the gendarme, police, military, whomever, and their influence, whom you would think kind of on the outside would be to help or protect, but actually is quite the contrary. So there was a fear that they would be taking away their condoms, and that's why we thought we'd go ahead and ask the question.
I have a question for you too.
Oh, okay. So what's the difference between the two groups? Yeah, so in the Burkina Bay, sex workers, we're looking at the kind of more traditional social support networks, so family, friends, and again, there's this kind of interesting dynamic among sex workers, and we have projects in Cameroon and also Cote d'Ivoire, so what I've seen in other countries as well is that sex workers, because of their profession, rely a lot on each other, but then there's also a strong distrust, especially among the younger sex workers, in terms of clients, because they're basically competing for clients, right? So these street-based ones. So that's really a concern, and I think for the women from Nigeria, most of the folks were from the outside were from Nigeria. There is a strong network amongst them again, and they don't have their family support, they don't have their friend support that the Burkina Bay women might have. But as I was kind of hinting at earlier, a lot of them are also trafficked, and so I'm not sure exactly how their relationship is with their pimp. In terms of the social support they get. So that's also kind of a new area to explore, I guess, in the future. Thanks.
They were no longer funding depression, anxiety. It wasn't serious enough. And I guess because it's so common among the women that they were really only funding schizophrenia, bipolar, schizoaffective, some of the more serious diagnoses. And so, again, I mean, there's always medication changing in that to adjust and to figure it out. But it was just a real concern for me. And I think, like I said, in terms of a public health environment, I thought this is something that's really concerning, that one, the policy that, you know, we're less interested in depression and anxiety and moving towards, you know, more serious drugs, but just sort of that very question of what happens then, are they on these medications that they're really not, they don't have the disorder and they're on these medications for no reason.
We need to end up. I want to thank our speakers. This was fascinating, and I appreciate your attendance.